Can you hear me?
Yeah. My mind's amply amplified. I'm just recovering from some kind of lurgy, and therefore my voice may not be what it should be. First of all, I'm not going to be talking about empiricism. I'm going to be talking from the point of view of the serious empiricist. And for a serious empiricist to talk about about empiricism would be like a serious fish talking about water. I'm inside it. I talk from the inside. I start from a similar standpoint to that of Wilfred Sellers. And by the way, this is the first authority I shall be mentioning. In his Myth of the Given. To recap on his famous essay, he demonstrates logically, and I shall not be demonstrating anything logically, that the idea of raw data is impossible. It is either raw and not data, or it is data and not raw. Data, which is the Latin for given, which is why it's called the Myth of the Given, has to be something usable, able to be, to relate to other data, to fit into a coherent whole. But to be raw, the experience has to be independent of other experiences and able, and independent of prior knowledge. Put it another way, when I report that I see an apple, I brought my own apple along, even a raw apple, that experience in its raw state is of a field of differences of colours and shades and forms. And I don't even know their colours or shades and forms. All I can perceive, all my senses give me, is a flicker of difference, as a dapple speckle. Such differences do not at this stage fit into any schema, any pattern or body of the known that would qualify as data. It gives me nothing in that raw state. What is needed in order for those differences to become data is a way of relating them to other differences. My suggestion is that the way we have found in it is via our memory, or rather the abilities afforded by and through our memory. What Sellers actually says is, and it's on your sheet in front of you, the essential point is that in characterizing an episode of a state as that of knowing, we are not giving an empirical description of that episode or state, we are placing it in the logical space of reasons of justifying and being able to justify what one says. That is what I brutally come to, data is not raw. Now, has what I've been saying been data? That's what seems to be the problem of knowing. What is raw as apparently leaves our sensual input hanging free, unconnected to anything that can be called knowledge. He suggests that a connection can be made via a language learning process and by something more radical, our reflexive capacity. So these are suggestions of Sellers, which I shall now be exploring. Language learning capacity, reflexive capacity. Our ability to know that we know and to remember that and what we remember. We are capable of this cyclic activity. If I am to take empiricism seriously, be a serious empiricist, my starting point has to be that blank state with no knowledge but some abilities. No prior knowledge, no prior innate ideas, just abilities. No knowing means maximum doubting, except I haven't anything to doubt at this stage. The title of this talk is not a defense of empiricism against rationalism. It's an attempt to discover, by assuming nothing, just which abilities are actually needed in order to get from the fact of experience to where we are and how we humans function. First, clearly, the ability to experience via the senses, to hear, see, touch, smell and taste, those are the first abilities. With those in place, with nothing else so far, I'm ready to experience. I'm open to experience. But not to experience something. The baby in the womb sees nothing, smells, tastes and touches nothing. I don't say feels nothing, because how do I know? It hears stuff through vibrations, but how could it know that it's hearing vibrations? Only because the vibrations change. They change in volume, in pitch, in rhythm. So, its happy sleep before the world erupts has a common, constant background of its mother's body music. So maybe that's why you can send the baby to sleep with music. If the vibrations were continuous and unchanging, they would not be perceptible. If they were all the same, you wouldn't notice them. The other thing is, if they're all different, you wouldn't notice them either. If they were all the same, they'd be what we call white noise, and that is a perpetual background against which other things can be perceived. So Descartes was categorically wrong. From the starting point of maximum doubt, I cannot say I, because I do not know the difference between myself and not myself, between the world's business and my own. Even less the concept of thinking, which demands a classification of types of change. All I can know is that it changes whatever it is. But I have another ability, without which the rest would be irrelevant, memory. The notion of experience demands that I remember the changes. That's not all. I find I can and do arrange my memories of changes. I sort them, order them by time and place and association, because all of those things are in my memory, by significance and use, and what I come to call kind or type. That aggregate pattern I shall talk about later. Is this ability to arrange and order an intrinsic part of what we call experience? Experience would be futile without it, without the ability to recognize changes and similarities when they arise and respond accordingly. To be able to recognize similarities, I must be able to distinguish differences. That is absolutely logical, though. You can't notice a difference unless you've noticed what's the same. You can't notice what's the same unless you've noticed what's different. And to deal with them, I have to remember them, because that's what changes become in memory, differences. So my primary data is binary, similar or different. Similar equals no news, different equals news. What exactly do we remember? At this stage of the inquiry, there is no other way but introspection. I'm afraid, much as that method has been decried, it's not true to say that my memory is accessible only to me, because I can report bits of it, describe them, discuss them. If I want to investigate its capabilities, I can look at psychological investigations that demonstrate its fallibility and fabulations, the hallucinations, the ways we make up stories, etc., that Trevor was talking about. But I need to explore its possibilities. If I want to do that, then I have to remember my memories, re-experience my experiences. So we have the magic ingredient of reflexivity, recognizing our experience of experience, our introspection into introspection, and the process then becomes this cycle, a giddy spin, a multi-geared mechanism for generating a system of a complexity unknown elsewhere in nature. I do not exaggerate. What goes on in our minds is more complex than anything else known in nature. If it's possible, this is actually what we mean by consciousness, but let's not go there. On reflection, I can say I remember images, events, sounds, associated feelings and emotions, smells and tastes, pains, faces, words, especially rhyming, rhythmic words, interestingly. Tunes, insights, understandings, dreams, stories, and maybe more. As I make this list, I become aware that the different memories are recalled in different ways. Smells and tastes by recognition. Very hard to bring that to mind, a smell or a taste, but when you smell it again, you know it's there. Words by recall, yes, I can recall a word. Sounds by mimesis, by an imitation. I might not be able to remember in my mind how somebody said something, but I can imitate it. I can whistle or sing a tune. And if different abilities were being called, as if different abilities were being called upon in each case, kinds of memory are sorted, categorized by distinct abilities. images by introspection, music by mimesis, tastes and smell by association, events and facts by arrangements of words. Proposition, I think, in the jargon of this room. My different senses have distinct memories too. Within each category, there are memory experiences that are distinguished by differences. But there are also similarities and correlations, which enables types to be organized. How? Now, at this stage, there may be some skeptical question about the ability to do or make up all this complexity from this very simple set of abilities to recognize differences and similarities, to remember them, and to introspect, to the reflexive religion, to gather them together. Look at these models. DNA. DNA has four bases labeled with four letters. That is four similarities. Not more differences, if you arrange them in different ways, but that codes for every living form on the planet. And that's a lot more differences, of course. So those differences, those similarities make more differences, those differences make billions of differences. Binary code, which guides rockets to Mars, drives robots, and allows me to type anything I like, uses even fewer differences in the first instance. And language. A language is something I know a bit more about, so I'll describe that in a bit more detail. Our language makes use of, say, about 40 phonemes. Distinguished by about a quarter of the number of differences. Not a very nice looking person, you might think. It's actually the inside of a mouth. These differences can be labeled as labial, dental, palatal, up here, lingual, tongue, nasal, and that is when the whole thing is closed and the sound comes out through the nose. Open, that is when the mouth is open and the sound is, you have an open throat. Closed, which is the opposite. Rounded, that is when the lips are right like oo. Spread, e. Voiced, like mmm, like burp, as distinct from fur. And so on. Yet, its productivity, the productivity of that very simple system, of that very small number of differences, is infinite. Every second on this planet, millions of new sentences that have never been heard before are being pronounced. And that is the productivity of a very simple set of differences. So we're ready with that simple apparatus, a set of limited senses, memory, and an ability to sort by differences and similarity. I have the beginnings of a way of knowing. Cognition based on recognition of similarities. So similarities allow us to posit and form concepts, come to that in a minute, of both objects and regularities. There is an asymmetry between differences and similarities, whereas differences are absolutely necessary. Perception, that's the start point, that's the way to start from. They do not give us concepts, except as similarities between differences. Because we get some similarities, but we also get similarities between similarities and similarities between differences. Giving us systems of differences like colour and number. Similarities, though, confer straight to concepts of things, objects, so we may see similarities as things and differences as relations at this point. Language is obviously a human ability. I leave it to others to detail what the ability consists in, but for my purposes today, it's important to talk about naming. Naming and other symbol systems are of great importance because they enable us to order, arrange, and rearrange experience in our minds and to share what we have and do with others. It marks differences and similarities. It gives form to experiences, as to other simple systems, number, models, and averages, and so on. The ways in which we attribute names and signs vary widely. Clearly, a warning sign is not related to in the same way to what it represents, if indeed it represents anything at all, as my name or the words apple, water, and freedom. All of these things, whatever they are differently judged and measured and counted, if they are counted. How do we get then from differences or similarities to names? From the first primitive ability to distinguish to the ability to form propositions and argue about them. A wave of the hand and the utterance of the word reason is just to name ignorance. Let's look at that philosophical perennial colour. I'm going to do my bit of high-tech demonstration. Nothing on my sleeves. I hope I've got that right. There's an E there, you can't really see it, can you? Now, obviously there are differences between each of those letters, which is what allows us to read it. Not too much difference, by the way. If there's too much difference, you can't read so easily. Just enough difference. But there's also similarities, and I spot the similarities. That one, that one. I did make a mistake. I didn't. Okay, it meant to be that one. So, there you are. See, we have a colour which the crossword enthusiasts among you will immediately recognise as the colour red. And. No, we don't quite make. I've messed it up. But if I'd done the colours properly, you would also have had three nice colours here, in those two and that one, which make up most of the word green. So, what we've got, this should be, that should be green instead of blue, but, the point is that I've got similarities there. I've taken out the similarities, and I've got two colours. I've got a colour system. I've got a system of differences. I've got a couple of concepts, in this particular case, arbitrarily labelled green and red. Now, if we ask about, as philosophers do, the existence of colours, do colours exist? Then we get lots and lots of philosophical problems. But if our perceptions, our ideas about what's out there, are derived from differences in their absence, that is, similarity, we can see colour as just one dimension of differences. I've not heard even the most persuaded denier of the reality of colour, and plenty of them about, or upholder of the reverse spectrum theory, also deny any difference between colours. We do not have to know a colour, if there is such a thing, but simply to be able to distinguish a form it from its neighbours and relatives on dimensions of differences. A naming of those differences is then arbitrary. We can divide it by form, as in my printer's ink cartridges, or the Ringo 7, or by the paint charts 700 or 7000. We can name it by numbers, as in the British Standards chart, or by evocation. We can call it dawn blush. Colour differences are entirely empirical. Colours are what we say they are. Now, all this is the process of... Oh, incidentally, there was another difference going on here. It was a shape, but it was a form. This whole set of letters is made up of two forms. A straight form and a curved form. Every one of those letters can be made up of those two bits. There's only one difference there. Similarity is that they're forms. So we have a similarity of difference, as it were, between... Form is a similarity of difference, it's a concept. But just by arranging those two shapes in different ways, we get alphabets. And a lot of other things as well, incidentally. I'm talking now about learning. What the empiricist does, a serious empiricist like me, is learn. I never know anything. And the reason I can learn is because I don't know anything. I'm always learning. Other animals, other than the human, are equipped with instantly available complex abilities to know food from non-food, prey from predator, to stand up within minutes, walk about. We have to learn all of those things. Fortunately, we have time for that, a multiple of the time any other animal has. The unique ability we have is learning. I think it's much more important than reason, the classical, unique human ability. To learn does not mean to know. Knowledge is static, learning is dynamic. It builds, adapts, is... where are we? It builds, adapts, is context relevant, always context relevant. It seeks to be adequate for the job, not eternally true. The serious empiricists have the ability to learn by remembering in their own peculiar way, not by merely recording, but by acting on memory. Memory is notoriously fallible, but it's all we have. Anyway, how do we know that memory is fallible, or experience is fallible? By other experience. There's no ultimate judge of what's correct. It's other kinds of experience that tell us what is false experience. And we do some checking. We do it against other people's memories, repeats of memories, coherence and consistence of memories. Consistence, by the way, is another word for similarities, systems of similarities. By predicting and making mistakes. Making mistakes. Wonderful ability we have to make mistakes. Most philosophical theories of epistemology are linear. Kant had a very well worked out theory of how we get from one to the other. But it is true that thinking is linear. Logic is linear. Calculations are linear. And so it may appear that reason, in its largest sense, is also linear. But learning, which is not unreasonable to see as part of the faculty of reason, is not. Not at all. It wouldn't work if it were. It's iterative. It's cyclic. It proceeds by eating its own tail, building on its lesson last learned, thus forming a virtuous spiral that by circles goes forward. Imagine a factory that uses its own products as the raw material for new ones. And again, its only end product is improvement. One can see this difference as similar to that between deductions and induction. Deductive logic can prove theorems because it's static. It deals with a static world, an ideal world. Induction learns and builds, continually builds on experience. And because the circles can loop between perceived differences and differences between differences, etc., etc., and the evidence of all its senses, of evidence from others, and past and long past, because of all that hugely complex interrelating and intermeshing, we are also the learning animal par excellence. Another point. We are not passive. We don't just absorb stuff. We go out and get it. Our actions not only enable us to identify cause-effect relations, for example, similarities and differences in what happens when other things happen, but they also demand the integration of all our senses, our hearing, our sight, smell, taste, and touch. Above all, touch. And touch ourselves, touching ourselves. Babies are always putting their hands in their mouth, putting their feet in their mouths. What a wonderful thing when a baby learns that that thing down there, it's his, it's hers. You know, she can suck it and taste it. It's part of her. And she does it by guessing out to her mouth and going, lovely. Such integration needs the concept of object, the hand. Look at that wonderful hand-sized thing. Was the hand developed for the apple, or was the apple developed for the hand? Who knows? But look how it works. Isn't it beautiful? A fit. That is the paradigm object. When we were swinging on trees, we went out and grabbed one of them. Then we put it in our mouth. Oh, yum. This is the manipulable thing. Man manipulates and manages the world. The man prefix in manipulate derives from manus, hand. And our hands have experience too. Or rather, we have experience of what our hands are doing and what they feel and how this integrates with other things. Sight, for example. Hands are active senses, reaching out and taking apart and rearranging bits of the world. Taking apples apart, skinning them and eating them, just as our thinking does. That's what I think. Our thinking does very much what our hands do. Taking apart things, putting them together, rearranging them, taking them out of there. Our minds are doing just the same. And where are we? Through our hands, through this touch, this action, we experience the cause-effect relation intimately. We can hope, expect, anticipate what they will do and how the world will react. Our hands perceive at least as much as, and perhaps more than, our eyes and ears. There's a nod here to Heidegger, but I won't go there. The object acts as a magnet for other experiences. So, I say that apple is red. I don't say redness abides here. The object becomes the magnet for, in Western philosophy, normally the object is what it all centers around, and we attribute qualities and properties and all sorts of things to objects. It doesn't have to be that way. So that it's graspable. It's objective. We can grasp not only with our hands, but with our minds. We can see it move across the background. We can make it travel. We can change its relationship to other things. And it encapsulates all these similarities and differences we've been talking about. Our cogitations, our philosophy to a very large extent, clusters around this notion of the object. And by the way, I've mentioned cause a couple of times, and this marks a lacuna in what I'm talking about, because I've decided to cut causality. It would just have made everything too long. Using hands and eyes and ears and taste, we are now active collectors of experience. That is a large part of our role in the world. Unlike what we imagine the life of most animals to be, we do not just go from meal to meal, from fight to fight, but seek out, sort out, braid, remember, and homogenize experiences into usable clusters. Usable maybe for finding better, easier meals and ways to fight, but at least with some idea of better and easier. That's very, very important. This improvement, this learning, this moving on. Because, undoubtedly, Platonic idea of ideals, or Socratic idea of ideals, that isn't primary. What's primary is the idea of better, not best. Better is much more important to us than best. Our sense of direction is astonishing in the natural world. Swallows can fly south. We can go in any direction we like. We can use experience to know where we're going, what it's like where we're going, ask other people. We feed the past into the future and change it. At least, from our point of view, we do. If we are machines, we are machines for processing time, not merely measuring it by learning. All agree that our memories and even our intuitions, this is objectivity I'm talking about now, can be unreliable, inevitably subjective. So the basic material of experience and the bedrock of empiricism is on shifting ground. The serious empiricist seeks support or confirmation. Warranty in the language of the argument between empiricists and rationalists. She uses the tools of objectification. She goes from subjective to objective. She has that ability. She connects the informed and interrelated experience of others, goes to libraries, she quotes sources, she builds card indexes. She uses machines and lenses attested as reliable by others. She submits the coherence of her arguments, relations between relations, to others. In this process, she begins a movement towards the comfort of certainty, from an individual belief to a collective one, solidified perhaps in texts. Wiles uses quotes and references. Take the model of a person constructing an academic paper. Or a book. They, having written the first thing, they submit it to, like, you see, the acknowledgements. I acknowledge the help of so-and-so, who made these very useful suggestions, so on, so, etc. They give a bibliography. They give their sources. All this creates an objectified text, something that has been created by agreement, consensus. The language itself does that as well, of course. But that's what objectification is. And objectification is respectable as well. Where are we? But the gain in confidence is at the cost of a loss, the loss of original information. My perception of the sample in the initial, in the raw state, is replete with information. There's an infinite amount of information there. When I say an apple or the apple, almost all of that is lost. It's been reduced to a pale, dim shadow of itself. The loss can never be recovered for two reasons. This process of codification, of turning that into apple, of forming and making understandable, degrades the information, strips of unnecessary detail. A description of a horse takes out the smell, the stamp, the flash of the eye. If all was recalled, it is useless. It's an unarticulated, inchoate heap, or lump, which is what Sellers is saying. The process also distorts, because in order to fit the available vocabulary, ready-made forms, there can be nothing entirely new and fresh about the consensus. How can we all agree about your dreams or your first love, for example? There's no going back. We cannot revisit the experience. Objectivizing entails loss and distortion, each a form of the other. So it's objectivity's ever receding target and ideal. But we have to recognize it for what it is. Unfortunately, we also regret that loss. We're constantly yearning back. And philosophers are as guilty as anyone about this yearning back, trying to go back to what they call qualia. What is this thing? Why can't I? How is it I can't account for my first smell of an apple. You can go back. There is a way, a very simple way of going back. It's in my hand now, the indexical. Instead of talking about an apple, the apple, an idea of an apple, I see this apple. That is the way I go back from the objective to the immediate, full, information-loaded experience. And we can re-experience it like that. Artists like Chardin and Cézanne have tried to capture some of this fullness of that experience. What is left over when the word has been said? Ironically, perhaps, this is the obverse of Wittgenstein's falsification of what he calls the Augustinian theory of language learning. The pointing game can't get you from the object to the word, but it can get you from the word to the object. Or rather, you're the subjective experience of the object. And the most important indexical of all to the serious empiricist is I. If you look at people doing sign language, their sign for I is that. It's so obvious. That's the index called I. And that's a circle. It makes a complete circle. I come back home. There's no mystery for the serious empiricist about who she is. It's me. The circle is complete. Now, I think I'm going to stop now. I have had several conclusions here, but they're on that piece of paper, and you might still use that. So, any questions?
You've got about 2 minutes.
2 minutes for a question.
The other person is you to speak now.
Yes.
You said you're a serious empiricist, but are we all serious empiricists?
Oh, by no means, no, we wouldn't be here if we were. I mean, all this chatter would not even start if we were all serious empiricists. A lot of the questions just wouldn't arise. Yeah. No. No, we're not.
So you are, but I might not be.
I am today, yes. I might get confused later, who knows?
Is serious empiricism the same thing as critical rationalism? Is serious empiricism, as you've just described it, the same thing as critical rationalism?
Critical rationalism.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't know from where I stand, actually, because I have no idea what rationalism is even talking about. So, all I can say is I have these abilities. And I don't know, if one of my abilities is rationality, I've already explained a lot of that. What I haven't gone into in detail is how I interrelate these things. I mean, if it's red, it's not green. Okay? But on the other hand, if it's dawn blush, is it still red? It's not green, but I mean, is red dawn blush? Now that raises certain problems. But I think I can sort those out empirically. I don't think I need a lot of rationalities to bother with that. Okay?
Well, very quick. One more question.
Yes? Peter.
My attention was caught by your distinction between learning and knowledge. You said something like, we don't know things, we just learn things.
As an empiricist, I cannot honestly say that I know anything. I am constantly learning. And that's all I want to do.
I'm only thinking that the aim of learning is knowing things, to succeed at learning.
Well,
if you never know anything, then you wouldn't learn anything.
It depends how you use the word know. So, I mean, there's a sort of finality about the word know and true, both those words. They're a stop point. Whereas if I'm learning, I can always say, this is what I've learned. I may learn something different tomorrow. In fact, I have to admit the possibility of that not being knowledge in order to learn something tomorrow.
Right, on that very controversial note. Thank you very much.